Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And, oh, I am delighted to have Bill Engdahl back on the program again. He's getting to be pretty much a regular on this program. And I get asked, when will Bill Engdahl be back on the program? And I just say, stay tuned, he will be. And today is the latest day to have Bill back on again. Listeners to the program, I think, are getting pretty familiar with Bill. He's, for many years, for a few decades, he's been a leading researcher, an economist. His books are absolutely sensational, must-reading. The two that I've read, A Century of War and Seeds of Destruction, they are absolute must-reading. You can easily get information about them. Email me. I'll tell you how to get hold of them. They're very easy to get and absolute must-reading. And Bill, I think, has a new book about out. Full Spectrum Dominance, Bill, is it out yet?
It'll be out sometime in the middle of May, if everything goes well. It's right in the last crossing of the T's and dotting of the I's and final editing.
As they say, the ink is still drying.
Yeah. It's any day now it should be finished. I'm just waiting for the Library of Congress answer and put that in on the inside front page.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait to read it. Have you got another one in the works as well? Because I see you have mentioned another title,
The Power of Money, The Rise and Fall of the American Century. Yeah.
Now, when is that?
I expect, if all goes well, to have out sometime in the mid to late summer. I don't want to jump the gun on that because the Full Spectrum Dominance has to come out. Actually, the Full Spectrum book was largely written about a year and a half ago when the whole tensions between Russia and the United States escalated around the missile defense placements in Poland and the Czech Republic, and I realized that nobody, not any of the European public debate and no government was talking about the real danger of this missile defense, which was to make a nuclear first strike on the part of the United States a physical possibility for the first time since the 1950s.
Oh, indeed.
And putting the world on a hair trigger for nuclear war by miscalculation.
The idea that it's defense, Bill, of course, it has nothing whatsoever to do with defense. It is all offense all the way.
Yeah.
And the reason that the Russians are so damn angry about it is they should be.
Yeah.
But that's a topic for another program, Bill. The Power of Money, that will be on, well, I mean, we will get to that in the future. But I guess that's talking about the current debacle and what it's doing to this country.
Well, it's the part three of my trilogy that I've been working on for some years. The first one was keyed off of the quote from Henry Kissinger back in the 70s.
Oh.
You control oil, you control entire nations, you control food, you control people,
mm-hmm.
you control money, you can control the whole world. And The Power of Money, The Rise and Fall of the American Century is about the role of the what was called by Congress around World War I is the money trust. The role of the money trust, the Wall Street power in virtually creating a constitutional coup d'etat over the due process of the American Constitution in order to create a control for private interests of the not just the United States through securitization. They've tried to simply take over the capital flows of the entire planet and fail miserably, I might add.
You know the music. We have to take a break. I still like the term money trust. I use it quite often.
Uh-huh.
And money changes and the rest. Those terms draw blood, Bill, so I like to use them. Let's take a break and we'll be right back.
All right. Okay.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Certainly struck my interest, and it isn't an earth-shaking event in the New York Times, but it's a little bit different than what they usually do. I believe it's dated April 26th, so I guess this was published yesterday in the New York Times. And my understanding was it was a feature, front page story written by Joe Becker, J-O, and Gretchen Morgenstern. I know who Gretchen is. Extremely long. And it's titled, Geithner is Member and Overseer, Forged Ties to Finance Club. I went through it. It's nowhere near as critical as something you would write, Bill. So they pull their punches greatly. But let me just, but the fact that they did this and they were critical, I don't know whether they're, I'm a skeptic. I honest to God don't believe that they're criticizing the system, because I have done media critiques where I have just savaged the New York Times on the role it plays as an apologist for the empire. Going back so many years, I mean, apologizing for the absolute most atrocious acts of government, whether it was all the tax cuts and deregulation, going back probably to Jimmy Carter deregulating the airlines, all the way through the 80s and the 90s. And again, I mean, just being a front man with having the most powerful media voice in the world. So for them to criticize something, you have to say, no, what's going on? Are they criticizing what's happening? Or are they just bringing out the long knives for Tim Geithner? But they say this about him. Oh, he played such a central role in fashioning overly generous acts to the financial industry at taxpayer expense, adding a couple of my own words. And then they say, an examination of Mr. Geithner's 5 years as president of the New York Fed, comma, an era of unbridled and untimely disastrous risk-taking by the financial industry, comma, shows that he forged unusually close relationships with executives of Wall Street's giant financial institutions. One more thing. His actions as a regulator and later a bailout king often aligned with the industry's interests and desires. According to interviews with financiers, regulators, and analysts in a review of Federal Reserve records, and they go on to describe how we've had clubby dinners and lunches with these guys, the Jamie Dimons of the world, and so on. And, I mean, basically, he was just one of the team, and whatever they wanted is what he did. But they don't quite draw the blood that they should. The fact that they did it, I found, was interesting, Bill.
Yeah, I did as well. The point is, there's a split within the establishment, I think, right now. Geithner is bungling the job badly. His job was to create a bank bailout for the money trust, the Wall Street money trust institutions, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, et cetera, the top six or eight institutions that are at the heart of this cancer, if you want to call it that, this toxic cancer on the global financial system. And Paulson had created such animosity through this $700 billion blank check that he blackmailed Congress into giving him back last October through the TARP program, that Geithner's job was to come in there and, through his schoolboy smile and his nice, innocent grin, to convince Congress and the American public that he wasn't actually coming to the taxpayer for another bank bailout, that he was going for a private-public partnership. Well, if you look at the fine print of that, as I've written on Global Research and elsewhere, it's nothing but the same taxpayer bailout laundered through the FDIC. And many people are onto that, such that it's creating a huge backlash for the Obama administration. But this shouldn't surprise people who naively thought Barack Obama was something radical outside of the Beltway establishment, and he was going to challenge the money trust, the Wall Street interests, special interests, and so forth. They were quite naive, as now many of them are beginning to realize and are telling me.
Bill, I was not one of the naive to think that Obama would re-change.
But let me just give you an example of someone who recently popped up on the radar screen. Most listeners probably haven't heard of Michael Froman.
Oh, I think I've heard the name, but I honestly don't know who he is. Who is he?
Okay. Michael Froman is the person who's going to be the point person between the National Security Council, which is usually considered an intelligence and military-oriented foreign policy institution of the president. He's a bridge between the National Security Council and Larry Summers, White House economic policy office in determining trade policy and international economic policy for the U.S. That means he's the desk officer for financial and economic warfare of Washington and America Incorporated. Well, Michael Froman is the person who opened the money doors, the doors of the money trust, to his former Harvard Law School roommate, a man by the name of Barack Obama.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, his first job was to introduce Barack Obama to Robert Rubin, who was then vice chairman of Citigroup, in the middle of creating this incredible scam called securitization of subprime mortgages and other assets. So, you know, the fact that Geithner is taking some heat right now, the entire crew around the Obama administration is absolutely corrupt up to their ears with incestuous relationships to the money trust, or as the New York Times calls it, the finance club. Pick a nice soft word for it.
Bill, let me mention the second to last article you have posted on Global Research, and you can talk about some of what you wrote in it. You call it, I think it was back around mid or late April, Geithner's Dirty Little Secret.
Yep.
The entire global financial system is at risk. And then below that, maybe Michelle added this, when the solution to the financial crisis becomes the cause. I mean, there's big stuff in that. I've written a little, you know, the deregulation study, but you can talk about that and bring whatever other points you want to bring into it.
Well, basically what Obama did when he made Geithner his Treasury Secretary, keep in mind, the New York Fed, where he was president for 5 years before coming to Washington, the New York Federal Reserve Bank is a privately owned institution whose shareholders, among others, are J.P. Morgan Chase. AIG was for years a shareholder, and Hank Greenberg was the chairman of the board of the New York Federal Reserve for years. And this is a private institution. This is Wall Street. This is not... So Geithner's mandate was to be the representative of the consensus of the most powerful banks in the world, the Wall Street Money Trust. And he came to Washington, but back in 1999, Geithner was a little bit below the radar screen as Assistant Treasury Secretary at a time when a man named Larry Summers was Secretary of Treasury, succeeding Robert Rubin. So it's a very, very incestuous little club here. But Larry Summers and Geithner were the instrumental figures at Treasury who succeeded in getting the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, and at the same time, a year later, got the Commodities Modernization Act of 2000 passed, which allowed financial commodities to be traded over-the-counter completely unregulated by any U.S. government authorities. And
yeah,
those two acts created the monstrosity that we're suffering through today in the economy and in the financial system.
And
they are the ones who ought to be standing in court on the accusation side and facing charges of criminal malfeasance for what they've done.
Absolutely, Bill. I mean, this is the most massive kind of fraud. You can be conquered as easily by financial warfare. Probably a lot easier by financial warfare than by military conquest.
Mm-hmm.
But these, I mean, they just rigged the system to legitimize the most massive fraud ever. And when
mm-hmm.
you're talking about deregulating the commodities markets, we're going to derivatives and some of the worst ones like credit default swaps. We're talking about many trillions of dollars of this junk held by banks. And, you can go into it. You talk about the big five holding 97% of the worst junk of all. I mean, this stuff, it's a house of cards that could fall apart.
Well, it is falling apart. That's what's called the financial crisis.
Well, I mean, they're keeping these beasts alive. I mean, and they ought to just let them recognize a zombie as a zombie and let it be a zombie.
The point is that way back in early 2008, before Paulson and Geithner deliberately allowed Lehman Brothers to crash, to go under, and thereby detonated a worldwide financial panic, I'm convinced that the reason was they knew exactly what effect it would have. The reason they did that was to create the panic atmosphere in Congress to get this $700 billion blank check in Paulson's hands to bail out Goldman Sachs and his other Wall Street cronies from their malfeasance of the last 7 or 8 years, and trillions of dollars of malfeasance. So this is just, every place you look at this, the issue at point here, Stephen, I think is very simple. And with all these TARP and obfuscations like the PPIPP or PPPIP, whatever Geithner calls it, the basic issue is quite, quite simple. And that is, do the voters of the United States, the citizens of the United States of America, allow themselves to be controlled and ruled by a financial monarchy that's going to simply rob them to the bone and force them out of their homes?
We're breaking away, Joe.
Are we going to cut down the power?
I'll pick right up on that as soon as we come back. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
To the News Hour. I'm on with Bill Engdahl. Bill, continue on from where we had to take a break. It was a crucial point you were making.
Well, the basic point is that all of this back and forth between Geithner, between Treasury Secretary Paulson, and the Obama administration and the Congress boils down to one thing. Do we cut down these mega banks that were created by the repeal of Glass-Steagall by Geithner and Summers back in 1999? Banks with a balance sheet of more than $2 trillion. Bank of America has a $2.1 trillion balance sheet. At its peak a year ago, Citigroup had a $2.2 trillion balance sheet. I mean, these are institutions. The expression is too big to fail. That's what Wall Street says to Congress. We're too big to fail so we can get away with murder. But in my view, these institutions have become too big to save. And the only thing that can be done is to put them into receivership, take their toxic waste assets off of the books into a sequestered entity, and write their book value down to zero until it can be sorted out what's worth and what's not worth, so you don't have any illusions about paying market value for toxic waste, subprime asset-backed securities, or credit default swaps against various banks that are brain-dead banks at this point. So these rules of receivership are on the books. They have been on the books for years since the S&L crisis. The FDIC is the institution mandated to put these banks in receivership, and they should have been doing that long ago. But it's a political decision by Wall Street not to allow that to happen. And congressmen who depend on Wall Street financial largesse for re-election money has labilely gone along with this. And it's a absolutely criminal misconduct and abuse of the trust of office that is taking place here, everywhere from the White House down to the House of Representatives and the Senate of the United States.
Bill, I believe that when Obama decided he wanted to run for the presidency, and probably there was something done where he was vetted before maybe he even made that decision, and basically he or anyone else who even has a chance to get the nomination, I think things are explained to them that this is the deal. The real powers that run the country, I don't think it has to be spelled out to any of them, but the deal is we could just call it the power structure. We run things, and if you want to be considered as a candidate to sit in that office that's oval-shaped and call yourself president, then understand that we make the rules and we decide what we'll be. And if you take this job, you won't challenge this. You'll go along with it. And if you promise us you will, and if you lie to us and we discover that, we'll kill you. We did it before. We did it several times before. You're very vulnerable. We can get you away from Sunday. So anybody who decides to do that, I'm not apologizing for Obama. My soul is not for sale. His was. George Bush's was. My soul is worth a lot more than they have money in their till to pay me. So he accepted the deal, and he's gone along with it. And whatever these people want, this private banking cartel just sucking trillions of our money into their pockets, mm-hmm. when the solutions, as you say, the solutions aren't hard to do. We could fix this problem. Of course, it never should have happened in the first place. But okay,
well,
we've got
the
it.
Point. When you deregulate finance, it's like giving an alcoholic an open chit at the bar and say, "Well, just put it on credit, and we'll talk about it later."
Or leaving the bank vault open and just saying, "Well, free samples in there. Take whatever you like." And of course, they get what they want, and they've run into trouble repeatedly over the years. Back in the 1980s, the SNL debacle, but this one is a lot bigger. And Bill, I guess
this
possible.
The world has never seen anything of the scale of this. This is
this is massive. I mean, nobody can know. You see a dark decade ahead. I agree with you, but maybe they'll find a way to somehow temporarily reinflate this monster and keep it levitating for another year or two. I don't know. But if they do that, they'll end up with something even worse than what we have now. And this thing is going to collapse, and it's just a question of whether we're going to do it now. The old line, you can pay me now or you can pay me later. But the later you wait to pay me, the worse this darn thing is going to be. But, of course, ordinary folks like you and me and everybody else, everybody listening to this program, we're the ones that pay the price biggest. And the big guys are sucking away billions and billions of dollars into their offshore Cayman bank accounts or whatever, wherever they stash their money. Maybe not in dollars, maybe in something, whatever else. Whatever they know is safe, because they rig the game to make it come out right for themselves. So they'll be okay, and the world can go up in flames. Oh, Nero comes to mind vividly.
Yep.
I do get a bit carried away, Bill. Hey, are you still there?
I'm still here.
you want me to keep up hyperventilating?
Adjusting what you just said. Yeah.
Oh, you write about it as an expert. I'm just a commoner, an absolute commoner. So I go out and I do the research and I write about it too. It absolutely incenses me. I didn't grow up in a beautiful country, Bill, but it was a hell of a lot different than what's going on today. My goodness, a poor kid like me could go to one of the top schools in the country, and in my freshman year, for the whole year, pay $600 in tuition, so that I could work and pay for the whole damn thing myself.
Yep.
Impossible today.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Bill Engdahl. Bill, let me throw another little tidbit at you. In an article I did a couple of weeks or so ago, I quoted William Black, who was, a regulator or prosecutor back in the SNL crisis.
Right.
He now teaches at the University of Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, he picked all of the bailout money to AIG as his worst example of what we did. And his reason was that they were given all this money to bail out counterparties, and he cited Switzerland's UBS bank. They got billions of dollars in counterparty repayment. At the same time, we were prosecuting them for tax fraud. I mean, that's enough to get your blood boiling.
Well, the point is, as Black very clearly laid out in the piece in Barron's 2 or 3 weeks ago, And he was part of the whole cleanup process of the SNL crisis, as you point out. The money that taxpayers have been paying to keep AIG Insurance Company afloat has been recycled. And the reason that there's been this great boom on the stock market for the last weeks, especially in the financials, has been the payment of taxpayer money through AIG to make good the credit default swaps held by Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and so forth, Wells Fargo. So the money is just going through a washing machine and coming out the other end to show up as this huge boost in quarterly profits on the books of these Wall Street institutions of the money trust. So and that is being used as a hype to create this false sense, a very dangerous sense of end of the crisis, recovery is in view, and so forth. So the AIG story has a much more sinister aspect to this than even the UBS one. The UBS one is about international politics and pressure on the Swiss to get a hold of some of that money for the Wall Street banks.
Oh, indeed. Well, I think at least as bad as handing UBS billions of dollars, the fact that Goldman Sachs was one of the architects of designing this this counterparty repayment, so that 13 or so billion dollars would be handed over to them.
Well, the way it was done, if you remember, Stephen, the way it was done was a closed door meeting back last right around the time that Paulson and Geithner let Lehman Brothers go belly up. They had a meeting with the chairman of AIG together with Blankfein, the chairman of Goldman Sachs, the only Wall Street institution invited to that as the biggest counterparty holder of credit default swaps that AIG had issued. And there's where the seeds were laid for this unprecedented taxpayer bailout, $180 billion to date, and it's by no means over, that AIG has gotten from U.S. taxpayers. And the government doesn't have one single vote in the board of directors on deciding policy of AIG. It's all passive preferred stock. It's just absolutely inconceivable what the way that this is being done.
Oh, indeed. And again, I mean, this thing absolutely, people really need to understand what the devil's going on. And to realize just the overwhelming harm that this is doing to so many people. And as you say, Bill, the worst is still to come. I mean, this is a raging storm that is going on, and the banks manufacturing profits out of thin air when they're sitting with trillions of dollars of absolute junk that could just come crumbling down on top of them if something isn't done artificially to prop them up. Who knows just exactly what is going to unfold in the months ahead? But you know, whether it happens sooner or happens later, this damn storm has legs, and it's just going to go on and on. You talk about a dark decade. I don't think you've changed your mind on that.
No, not at all. The look at the top six banks. You know, we had this a charade going on about putting the banks through an FDIC stress test. That's the big word of the week here in Washington, putting the banks through stress tests. Well, the presumptions of the stress tests in terms of unemployment levels, in terms of home mortgage foreclosure rates and so forth, have already been exceeded in the last two quarters of actual economic data. So the stress assumptions are sanitized to make sure that almost all banks will come through with golden colors. But that ignores the fact that the banks are overexposed to default risk to the tune of hundreds of percent of their risk-based capital. And these banks are undercapitalized. We're talking about the highest risk institution out there is Goldman Sachs, the highly, highly leveraged institution. HSBC USA, which is Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, London Bank, largest bank in UK, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, Bank of America. These institutions are literally the most overexposed institutions in the world right now, these megabanks, and that's a direct consequence of the deregulation that Geithner and Larry Summers put into play back in 99-2000, and before him, the ball got started rolling by Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, the great just-retired guru of Citigroup, so, and formerly of Goldman Sachs, of course. So this thing is far, far from over, and the dangers are being buried and kept, deliberately kept by responsible public officials like Geithner, kept from the public's knowledge.
And Bill, in your Dirty Secret article, you talk about five U.S. Megabanks holding 96% of the troubled derivatives
right.
Assets. And, I mean, let's name them, J.P. Morgan Chase, but by far with the greatest number, what, $80, $90 trillion or something like that. I don't have the numbers in front of me. Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and Wells Fargo.
Yeah.
Those are the edifices of Wall Street. And those are the ones that we just ought to shut them down and put them out of business.
Well, they ought to be put into receivership. We have orderly ways to do this so we can minimize the taxpayer loss. But the way it's being done now, we're just having an open spigot of taxpayer money into these institutions to allow them to keep doing the high-risk games that they've been doing ever since they were deregulated 10 years ago. That's lunacy to the cubic degree here. It's just unbelievable.
Oh, indeed. And of course, Larry Summers, when he was Treasury Secretary, he got Glass-Steagall repealed in 1999, and then in 2000, Commodity Futures Modernization Act, that it just was an open sesame to let these people do whatever they wanted in trading the most risky stuff, leveraged up to the hilt, turning themselves into a mega casino.
Right.
I mean, really a mega casino where at some point or other, you know, you can only roll sevens and 11s so often. Sooner or later you're gonna hit snake eyes. But you know, I mean, they've got the great put behind them, the Fed and the U.S. Treasury, to come to their rescue. So who cares? I mean, take any bad risk you want, unlike
well,
us.
Well, that's been Tim Geithner's approach his entire history, both in the Treasury and in the New York Fed, and now is back in the Treasury again. Use taxpayer money, and we don't care how much they have to suffer. The main thing is help our friends in Wall Street.
Oh, indeed. And when you've got a banking cartel, Bill, controlling the money supply, the old statement by, I think, a couple of the old Rothschild family going way, way back, where saying, you quote Henry Kissinger or anybody saying, you know, just give me the money and I don't worry about anything. You control everything. But the Rothschilds, I've seen at least two quotes. I've used one and I plan to use another one. We're basically saying, you know, I mean, just give me control of the nation's money, and I really don't give a damn what kind of laws you pass. I mean, that makes me boss. I mean, I'm. You could have a monarch, but the monarch has no crown. I wear the crown. That's basically
well,
what he's saying.
Monarchs throughout history have been forced to turn to the money trust in one form or another over centuries to finance their wars, and then they get into debt, and they have two choices. Declare state bankruptcy or hawk the kingdom to the banks, which is the usual course that ended up. And that's where we are right now in the United States.
Oh, indeed.
The United States political process, the control over the economic process, has been hawked to the private banking interest, this cartel of five or six institutions that we've mentioned. And the question is whether the American public is ready to say, okay, we take what's justly ours back and put it under public supervision. This is not socialism. This is not some form of communism. This is the way that the founding fathers established the relationship of the control of money under the public trust in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8.
Well, they did say that only the Congress has the right to coin money. They should have talked about print, and they should have mentioned paper.
No. This is all red herring, Stephen. This is red herring. It's very clear in the Constitution. If you look at the constitutional debates, the Federalist Papers, and so forth, it's quite clear that they meant the control of the money power should be in the hands of the Congress. and it's not paper money or coin money and so forth. It was the vernacular of the day.
Well, I do know that the colonists, before we became a nation in 70 to 76, they had their own script. They printed their own money, the individual states, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, all of them.
Back in the Great Depression, back in the 30s, we had members of the Senate who were actually proposing to re-federalize the Federal Reserve and take it out of the hands of the private money trust interests.
Well, I know Wright Patman in the House wanted it. He said some very nasty things about the bankers.
William Lemke of North Dakota from the Nonpartisan League, who my grandfather had a close association with back in the 20s, but
it never happened.
He was one of them.
Lincoln.
Well, it didn't happen then. Roosevelt certainly didn't want that. He was an arm of the money trust, disguised as a demagogue attacking the money trust. But in fact, what he did was reorganize it for their own self-interest.
Oh, he did. Well, he did. He did have the Pecora Commission that got Morgan's son to admit he hadn't paid income taxes for a couple of years.
Was just a whitewash. That was
Well, he didn't put them out of business. I mean, he may have slapped them on the wrist a little bit, but he certainly didn't slow them down, but didn't stop them. Mm. And indeed, Lincoln, to finance the Civil War, told the bankers to go to hell. And we printed greenbacks interest-free, inflation-free, and we grew the country because of it for a short time, kick-started it a little bit. But Roosevelt had the chance to do exactly the same thing, and he punted.
Yep.
And he had such popular appeal. I mean, the guy was beloved. Well, they probably would have killed him. They tried to kill him once, and they failed. But they probably would have succeeded if
Roosevelt.
Roosevelt.
Oh, that was a setup. It's later come out. That was a staged thing.
It was staged?
Staged thing, yeah, to get sympathy for Roosevelt. That was.
Oh, my goodness. What was the guy's name? Zarlinger or something or other? The guy who was killed, who took a bullet that supposedly was intended for Roosevelt?
You mean Mayor Cermak in Chicago.
Oh, Cermak was hit.
Cermak was hit, yeah, if I remember. But the recently it came out that the whole assassination attempt was staged to get sympathy for Roosevelt.
Now that's a story I didn't know.
Yeah. I'll check up on that, but that's as I recall the thing.
Was the same thing done?
That for my book on the money trust recently, and came across that, and it put a whole different light on it. So I decided.
What about when Reagan took a bullet? Was that to get him, or was that in the sympathy for him? We had George Bush as vice president.
Look at who Reagan's vice president was, who was a heartbeat away. And the fact that Mr. Hinckley, John Hinckley, his family up in Colorado were closest of friends with some of the Bush family, it begins to stink of a little bit of connectivity that perhaps Father Bush didn't want to have come out in the public. But it's certainly the case that after that, Ronald Reagan was very well behaved on critical issues in terms of the establishment.
Well, I, honest to goodness, didn't have any idea why anybody would think Ronald Reagan wasn't true blue for the power structure of the country. I mean, my God, I mean, even he afterwards, when Bush became president, he complained that George Sr. was being much too easy and not as hardline for the power structure as he was. But when a president takes a bullet or even somebody attempts to get him, you have to wonder what on earth is going on. Something is fishy. These guys are so well protected that it never should happen, at least since Kennedy rode around in an open limousine. But he should have been smart enough to know that he never should have done anything like that. Although, I mean, having a roof over your head wouldn't stop anybody. I mean, they can get you right through that roof very easily, even back then. But they took care of Kennedy. My goodness, I mean, Gerald Ford had a shot taken at him.
Squeaky Fromm.
Think how easily they could get us, Bill.
Squeaky Fromm. Squeaky Fromm and John Hinckley and all these wonderful people that
were
on the scene of history for a brief moment.
Oh, indeed. I mean, even presidents, James Garfield. was murdered in office less than a year, he said some very nasty things about the bankers. And he didn't last 1 year in office. The shot taken at him didn't kill him on the spot. He lasted a couple of months, but whatever the problem was that developed, infection or whatever, I think the bullet was in a tough place. They couldn't get it out. And he died a couple of months later. But I have no doubt that was a state-sponsored or a banker-sponsored hit. And Lincoln, I don't know who this John Wilkes Booth guy was, but Lincoln clearly angered the wrong people, so they murdered
him. Well, if you look at the Booth background, you'll find he had very close relationships to people in the leading position in the Confederacy. There were clearly some trails that led back to London on the Lincoln assassination, not just for the greenback issuance, but for the fact that Lincoln's policy on Reconstruction was not a punitive Reconstruction, but one of building up the industry and the economy of the South. And that's something that London bankers did not want to see at all. So I think they preemptively just made sure he was out of the scene.
And they were pretty potent back in those days. So we really have not quite come into our own yet, but we were moving along. The ability to print our own money, Bill, you know this much better than I. If the government printed its own money, we could do wondrous things are just impossible, giving this power to bankers to suck out the national wealth for themselves. We could have a stable economy, we could have no inflation, and we could get rid of the income tax. The income tax was passed to pay the interest of these bankers. Oh, my goodness, we have to take another break. Let's do it. We have a short segment left. Oh, we need another hour.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
To the News Hour. Just a few minutes left, Bill. You will come back around late in the month in May so we can continue this chapter. This is a story with endless chapters in it. And much too important not to have you back as often as possible, Bill, to pick up on it. Let me just mention your books again and then you finish up. Around mid-May, it looks like your next one, Full Spectrum Dominance, Totalitarian Democracy in the New World Order, will be out.
Right, right.
And then later in the summer, these two are absolute must reading on my list, and we'll talk about them both on the program. Maybe we can talk about Full Spectrum Dominance next time you come on.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, Power of Money,
yeah.
The Rise and Fall of the American Century.
I'd love to.
We have two programs right there, Bill.
There's enough problems in the world for plenty of discussion.
Oh, indeed. I mean, you could write book after book after book, and you can't cover them all. But you cover this stuff so well, and you write about things, Bill, important things that either no one else writes about, or few people write about, and certainly most people don't know about. That's why your books are so damn important. I mean, you've only got two out so far. This will be the third one coming out?
A third one coming out, yeah, and the fourth will be the money book. But the first one was The Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Policy in the New World Order, followed by The Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, which global research Michel Chossudovsky in Canada published. It was very difficult to find an American publisher. In fact, impossible to find one that had the courage to put the political agenda behind GMO into book form and get it into the American public. But the Michel Chossudovsky had that.
Oh, Michel, of course, also goes where few other people would dare go.
Indeed.
And this stuff is too important, and he doesn't back off from it, and you don't back off from it. You find it out and you let people know. I mean, you both taught me so very much. So I'm very indebted to the two of you, Bill. And that's why as you put out new material, I want to read it, whether it's in the form of articles or books. When your stuff or Michelle's comes out in articles on global research, I read it as quickly as I can. It's just too important not to read. And I urge listeners to go to globalresearch.ca. Oh, I know you do it anyway, but do it regularly every day and see the important new articles that are there and follow them. You wrote a geopolitical article last time, Bill. Anything new in the economy coming out?
Well, right now I'm working on the Food Modernization Act of 2009 and some of the implications for trying to covertly ram genetically modified seeds down the throats of African and other countries promoting a horrendous industrialization even more than it is already of the American food supply, the food chain in the United States. So I'm working on that, and the Obama administration is just a straight-line continuation or even an escalation of the pro-Monsanto policies of its three predecessors. So sadly enough, that's what I have to deal with right now, but that'll be out in written form sometime this week.
Oh, terrific. You're talking about H.R. 875, I think?
Yeah.
Well, I wrote about
it, too.
I wrote about two, and there are a few companion bills. One of them is to provide the funding. And, I smell the Monsanto monster lurking behind the scenes on this. Oh, I can't wait to read your article, especially since I had something to say about, the music means they're going to break away. Will you come back later in May and we'll talk
about
it?
We'll have to work it out, but we can do that by email.
I'll shoot you an email, and let's pick a date and come on back. I look forward to it, Bill. Again, my great, great thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Steve.
Top stuff when you're on the program.
I enjoyed it.
And we'll be back tomorrow. Another great program. Francis Boyle coming back tomorrow. Join us then.